Welcome to The Rehab on the Mental Health News Radio Network. I am Dr. Mark Leeds, and I will be your host. Join me in exploring the world of addiction treatment. How can we improve the ways that we help individuals to overcome addiction? The goal of treatment is to save lives and help people to get back on track to a path towards success and happiness in life. Today on the Rehab Podcast, my guest is Rachel Reimer of Ray of Hope, and welcome to the podcast, Rachel.
Thanks for having me, Mark. I'm so excited to talk to you.
Thank you. Now, I had never heard of medical intuitism until I contacted you and we communicated by email, and, you know, I read up on it. It's very interesting. Can you tell me a little bit about what medical intuitism is?
Sure. So a medical intuitive uses any kind of insight they get from the other side to go in and figure out why someone is ill. For example, with myself, I typically see shapes, colors, or a variety of other symbols. And this is going off of the amount of time and effort that I've been doing this work. I've come up with certain symbols for certain diseases and conditions. So when I go in and work with different providers, I'm able to kind of point them in a direction whenever they have stubborn cases or someone's not responding to treatment properly.
And how long have you been doing this? How long have you been consulting with medical professionals to provide, you know, information and when they reach out to you and ask for your help in making a diagnosis and, you know, or how to deal with a difficult patient where they can't figure out what's going on? How long have you been doing this?
I've been doing this since 2014. I have been able to pick up on these things since I was a young girl. I just didn't really understand how it worked, and I didn't quite put the puzzle pieces together. I didn't really understand why I would see these signs and symbols on people. It didn't quite make a lot of sense. So by the time 2014 came around, I really started to understand what was going on based off of a mentor that I had, and things were finally clicking. I was like, oh, okay, that makes sense. This is why I'm seeing this in this person. Oh, okay, now I know that when I see that in someone else, I know that this is something that they may struggle with.
Now, you had mentioned you get information from the other side. Would that be like maybe people who have passed away or entities who have never been human? And I imagine that there's good and bad entities out there. I mean, can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, so I don't necessarily get my information through one specific person. I do see people that have crossed over and they're no longer here. I typically don't get information from them. I normally just get my information from some kind of higher source. I don't necessarily have a name I associate it with. If I do have a name, I just call them God. I do also believe in entities and the other side of things, so more of the negative energies. I typically stray away from that. I normally don't interact with that side whatsoever, just because anytime they do come forward to talk, it's never information that'll help me or truthful information. Entities typically tend to feed off of fear and try to mislead you and misguide you on different ways. So I always look for a positive energy that I go in and work with. Typically on the visual aspect of things, that normally looks like a golden light, some kind of figure that's dressed in gold or white. Anytime I see something dark gray, black, something that doesn't really have any distinguishing features, I tend to stay away from, just because they've never helped me in the future, and they typically derail me if I do tend to interact with them.
Now you see things in pictures. Could it be pictures from any time period, like, you know, even a picture, say, from like the Civil War? Would you see something in an older picture?
Yeah, I am. This past summer, I actually went over to a Civil War site, and typically spirits that haven't crossed over just from trauma. Let's say that they die in a battlefield, they end up getting shot in the head or something, and they're not aware of it. They end up being stuck there. So I can definitely see things from different time periods if needed. So when I go in and do the medical side of things, I can go in and look at someone. Let's say I have a 39-year-old female. If I'm looking at them and I see a 6-year-old little girl, I know that that trauma that they're holding on to has to do with that time period. So that's when I would go in and ask that patient or that personal client what happened around the age of 6. It feels like it has to do with some kind of trauma with a family or a loved one or something with financial, or you witnessed something horrible. I would just go in and ask a few questions and just kind of help the patient realize what the actual trauma was.
And what about video? Do you get the same information from watching a video?
I do. Anytime I see a recent picture of someone, if someone's standing in front of me, if it's a recent video, as long as I can see them for what they are currently, I don't have any issues doing that on the medical side of things. It is an interesting question, though, because even when I get old videos of people or old pictures of people, sometimes you can still even see that physical problem years and years and years before they started complaining about it. I ended up going over to one old woman's house, and her husband died of colon cancer, I believe. And I was looking at one of her pictures. I think it was from the 60s that was on her wall. And I believe her husband was diagnosed with colon cancer in the 90s. And even in the 60s, I looked at that picture and I could still see the beginning of it starting to form. So my viewpoint with medicine is that sometimes we can develop and manifest things on an acute level if the trauma is severe enough. And sometimes we can also accumulate those beliefs and emotional patterns when we don't deal with them, and they build up over time. So to me, I have a hard time when people go into the doctor and say, oh my God, I had no idea I had stage 3 or stage 4 cancer. This cancer, these other long chronic illnesses have been developing for years and years and years of just not wanting to deal with something or not associating with that trauma or traumatic event that happened.
Do you do a lot of consultations or some consultations with, you know, preventative? Like, for example, there's cancers that are difficult or maybe even almost impossible to pick up early. For example, ovarian cancer. And now they've cut back on the screenings for prostate cancer, and which is maybe unfortunate. But do you get those kind of consultations, you know, people that they want to see that, you know, do I have possibly ovarian cancer or breast cancer, things like that?
I would love to. Just kind of the way that our society operates is people normally don't seek help until something's wrong. And typically they wait until something's really wrong, where they have pain to the point where they can't stand it anymore, and then they finally go in and see a medical professional. And then when they're at that point and they can't find anything that's wrong, or that medical professional isn't offering help that they want to take, then typically I'm their last resort. I have one or two people on occasion that come in just for preventative support, which is great. I would love to do more of that. I would hope that society's viewpoint on health and medicine will eventually shift more towards a preventative side of thing rather than management of symptoms. It's unfortunate. I would love to have people come in when they're not experiencing any symptoms and just say, hey, just so you're aware, picking up on this specific emotional thing, this is typically associated with a specific condition. That doesn't mean by any means necessary you'll develop it, but I just want you to be aware of it and work on it so that you can hopefully not develop anything in the future. But just from our current medical society, almost 98% of the people that come towards me are people that have had really devastating conditions and diagnoses.
And of course, I would never recommend that anyone skip over recommended medical exams. You know, you should see your doctor on a regular basis, you know, get things done that are recommended at the required time, such as breast exams and mammograms, colonoscopies. But if in addition to doing all of that, it can't hurt to come to you and ask for a consultation just to see what you might come up with.
Right. And I always like to tell people, I'm just an additional resource. I don't substitute for any kind of medical care whatsoever. If you fall off the roof and break your neck, I can't do anything about that. I'm not a spinal surgeon whatsoever. So we definitely need medical professionals in our society. I think they're extremely important, but I absolutely don't think it would ever hurt for anyone just to be aware of what's going on in their own body from an emotional standpoint of, what am I still holding on to that's no longer serving me? A lot of us have those stupid things that we remember and we're like, why am I still angry about that? As an example for me, I remember in second grade, that this girl asked for pencil lead from me, and she said she would give it back to me, and she never did. Why on earth am I still holding on to that? Those are those little itty-bitty things that stack up over time that kind of lead to a bigger thing of, okay, I have a problem letting go of resentment, and that leads to people hurting me. Why do I feel like everyone's trying to hurt me? Those are those big core beliefs that we can go and work on so that people can hopefully get past all of those physical symptoms that they're experiencing.
So the traumas that may have happened early on, maybe in childhood or years ago, when people hold on to them and can't let go of them, that so you're saying that can lead to illness later on?
Correct. So in cases like vaginismus, where a female has a hard time with just penetration or just enjoying sex in general just because it's painful, typically there's been some kind of trauma in the past, whether that be an actual physical trauma of rape or molestation or something like that, or an emotional trauma of parents not approving of having sex, society not approving of me having sex, even from a religious standpoint of my religion says that I can't have premarital sex. So there's a whole variety of reasons as to why someone could be physically manifesting a symptom. So when we go into, let's say a woman goes into a doctor's office with vaginismus and they just give her a pain pill and say, here, kind of suck it up. I don't know what else to do for you. I'm sorry that sex isn't pleasurable. Then that person maybe could start looking into other options as to why that developed in the first place.
And that's something I've dealt with patients who they come to me and I can't, as a primary care doctor, I can't figure out what's wrong with them. And I refer them to a specialist. The specialist doesn't have any answers. They, you know, probably delay by ordering a lot of tests and, you know, labs and images. And eventually we get no answer there. We try another specialist. And meanwhile, the patient may be having chronic pain or having some issue that there's no explanation for it. We've ruled out the really serious possibilities, but still the patient suffers. And we just, in the medical community, we can't come up with any answers. And, you know, until now, I'm thinking of one specific patient that just for years, you know, there was just no solution to what was happening with her. I mean, she had a pain in one of her ribs in the back, and no one could figure out what it was, and she tried everything. And, you know, eventually, last I heard, she was just learning to live with it and had tried a lot of alternative treatments. But I don't think anywhere along the way, none of us thought, you know, maybe this is due to some old trauma, you know, psychological trauma.
Right. And that's a point I like to make just from the energetic standpoint is the desk that you have in front of you is made out of energy. And it's vibrating, even though you can't see that. Same thing with the chair that you're sitting on. Same thing with the other things in the room that you're looking at. Just because we can't necessarily see something in energy form doesn't mean that it actually doesn't exist or doesn't come true. And just because we can't necessarily put a number behind it, it also doesn't mean that it isn't true. There are plenty of things in the universe that scientists still don't understand, but that doesn't mean that it isn't true or it doesn't exist. We just don't know why or how that happens. So I think it would be interesting in general just that the medical community open their mind to the viewpoint of treating someone as a whole entire person instead of just something like a machine that's broken or not working. When you go into a factory and you have a malfunction in the machine, you can just go in and put in a new part or tape it up or something like that. People don't work like that. Humans don't work like that. Even scientists have pointed out that the placebo effect does work in certain cases. Why is that? We haven't quite figured that out. So when a patient is getting a placebo, is it because that their belief system changed that this pill is going to work compared to the other treatments that they've had? I think that that's something that medicine can definitely go in and investigate a little bit more because it's certainly a shortcoming. Even though that we've made great strides in medicine, there is still, like you said, things that we just don't understand.
No, I'm an osteopathic physician, and osteopathic physicians, you know, we claim to be the doctors that we treat the whole person, and that's what distinguishes us from the MDs is that we, you know, we practice medicine just like an MD, but we also do some physical diagnosis and manipulation, and we treat the whole person. But in practice, a lot of DOs are really working just like the MDs. You know, we claim to look at the whole person and treat the whole person, but I don't think too many of us are really looking beyond, you know, the tools that we have available to us, you know, what the things that are FDA approved. And, you know, and of course, we should always stick with those tools and use those tools as we're supposed to. But it doesn't hurt to take that one more step and look beyond to try to get a little additional help, you know, with diagnosing our patients and helping to treat them in other ways.
Yeah, and another point I'd like to make, too, is that I think another major issue as to why MDs and sometimes DOs do that is just because of the time constraints that they're under. When they go in and work for a hospital or go and work for someone else in a private practice, they typically get scheduled, what, every 15 minutes now, 7 minutes? It depends on facility. Like, there's no way that you can sit down and talk to someone in that amount of time to see what's really going on. Let's say in urgent care, you have a little boy that comes in that has a fever and a sore throat. Instead of just giving him an antibiotic or, like, if he has a bacterial infection or strep throat or something like that, why wouldn't we sit down and ask, okay, in the past 2 days, like, have you gotten really angry over something? Did you end up yelling at someone else? Did you want to yell at someone else if you didn't? That conversation just takes 5 minutes just to sit there and figure out what it is. Even if we just add 5-10 more minutes onto an appointment time, that would help tremendously in just talking to the patient. Not to mention even just building patient rapport. How many people don't trust their doctors now because they take a pill and it doesn't work? And then they're like, my doctor lied to me. They have that impression in them. So I think that that would even just build a patient-doctor relationship. And that's kind of the way that medicine's starting to head into it, these concierge services where patients get unlimited time and they can go see their doctor that same day and their doctor knows who they are visually without looking at the chart. So I'm hoping that medicine is going more towards that concierge service still.
And it definitely is. There's definitely a group of doctors that are dropping out of the traditional medical system and starting, you know, what they call either micro practices or ideal clinics or concierge. I personally don't really like the term VIP and concierge, although mm-hmm. I sometimes use them, you know, because it shouldn't be exclusive or overly expensive. It should be accessible. There's also a movement, I think, called direct primary care. Where doctors will maintain a practice of a relatively small number of patients and give them a lot of time. Basically, they give them all the time they need, and it's a small monthly fee, and that covers as much care as you need. And so it's true, there is a movement going in that direction, and patients who are looking for that, for more time with their doctor, can seek that out, you know, and look up those kind of terms and find doctors that, and it's not overly expensive. It tends to be cheaper, actually, than having insurance that covers doctor visits. I wanted to ask you about, did you grow up in Iowa?
I did. I grew up in eastern Iowa in a town called Marion. So right now I actually live an hour south of St. Louis, and that's just where I've kind of set up housekeeping. But my business is still located in Iowa. So when I go home and I visit family and friends, I take care of any paperwork needs that I need to at headquarters. But otherwise, I just kind of like to work from my computer, like to go out and explore a little bit. That's just more of the lifestyle that I really enjoy, just because it allows me to work the best that I possibly can. I like to work when I feel like I'm able to work and I feel like I'm able to give insight, compared to having really strict hours where, okay, I have to do this case and this case and this case and this hour. Just because what I do is a creative process, and whenever you put, like, strain on that creative process, it tends not be as great. So I always give my providers and my personal clients, I always have them do a little bit of a time window just to make sure that I can give them as much information as possible.
When I looked at your website, when I looked at the contact page and there was a map of Iowa, it reminded me that I went to school in Iowa in the 90s. I think from 92 to 96, I went to school in Des Moines. And a friend of mine, her daughter, was getting involved in Wicca, and she was concerned about it, and, you know, concerned it might be something satanic or whatever. So we decided, just for the fun of it, to look up, you know, local Wicca meetings or Wiccan meetings, and we found one, and we went, and we found out that in at least in Des Moines, there's a very active spiritual community and people involved in. I don't know if it's a separate, you know, if everybody involved in that is in the Wicca religion or not, but a lot of, you know, we went to some meetings and sat around a circle and people talked. And I actually saw, I remember from that meeting, the first one, people looking around the room like they were seeing things in the room that weren't there, or things that I didn't see. And, you know, I talked to people later. They talked about, you know, what it's like to see or experience your first spiritual entity. Were you involved in that in Iowa?
I wasn't involved with Wicca, but I was. I do have friends in Iowa still that I go and talk to that can see similar things that I can. I don't really necessarily belong to a group, though. However, I can tell you certain stories that whenever I do go to events like that just to see what it's like, or kind of those metaphysical events and fairs and everything, I normally don't say really anything about myself except, hey, I was a student at the University of Iowa. I'm 23 years old. I just give very brief things. And I like to just sit and look at them, wait for about 2 seconds, and then they close their eyes, and then they look back up, and then they look at me, and they're like, you can do this too, can't you? And I'm like, yeah. So it's always cool to make that connection with people, because this is something that only a small number of people truly understand and have that connection with.
Yeah, and it's something, other places I've lived, I wasn't aware. Maybe I just didn't seek it out, but I was not aware of that kind of a community. And, there, you know, there was a lot of the New Age bookstore kind of places and crystal stores. And, you know, so it was a very different place than where I am now in Fort Lauderdale, Florida.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to find sometimes. It typically takes you knowing one or two people in the area, and then they're kind of like, hey, these are all these underground resources that you weren't quite aware of. But Marion and Cedar Rapids have gotten a lot better with that. I know in downtown Marion, there's a store called Realive, and they sell crystals. And I think in Cedar Rapids, there's a huge like practitioner building. I think it's called Illuminations Healing, where you can see, like, I think they have a, they do like hypnosis and just general tarot readings and psychic readings and stuff like that. So I don't really professionally do the psychic part or anything like that, even though I do have that ability. I really just choose to hone in on the medical stuff just because I think it's the most useful and it's the most fun for me to do. And it's probably the most in need for people as well.
And I want to bring up, just because the topic of the show is generally addiction treatment. Have you worked with people in the field of addiction or people suffering from addiction that need help either before they get medical help or after they've gotten clean?
I haven't dealt with someone specifically with that, but I'm around enough people that have actively said that they have addictions that I'll just go in and ask a few questions as to why that's there in the first place. For instance, typically the belief behind why someone smokes is, I don't want to deal with this right now. We hear that all the time when a smoker is really stressed out and they're like, oh man, I just need to go outside and have a cigarette. What's really going on in their mindset, whether that be conscious or unconscious, is, I don't want to deal with this right now. And that behavior has happened so long that every time that comes up of something that they don't want to deal with, they'd rather smoke a cigarette instead. And sometimes that manifests another way too, whether that just be food for the average everyday person. We come home from work on a very long day and you're like, you know what, I don't want to deal with any of this other stuff. I just want to put food in my mouth to avoid it. It's an avoidance behavior. Kind of the same thing with the smoking idea. So there's just a whole bunch of different emotional beliefs for different addictions. And that's kind of the hard part, that until an addict is really ready to deal with that, especially the emotional belief with it, normally I haven't had anyone change. They normally go back to their same behaviors. So I've always been curious on the provider end and on the rehab end, like what kind of emotional work that they do in rehab. Is that whether they make amends or they sit and just talk about things in general, or if they actually pinpoint that emotional belief?
A lot of the treatment community, the rehabs are all around the country, and it's accepted as the current medical model, or at least it has been until now, is based on spiritual principles, or the basically the 12-step program, the program developed by the Alcoholics Anonymous program and also used by Narcotics Anonymous. So, you know, when a person goes to rehab, they work the 12 steps, or they learn about the 12 steps, and they get exposed to the program and to meetings. And it helps. It definitely helps a lot. But at least in some types of addiction, the success rate is not very good. And we're finding that specifically medical treatment for opioid addiction, we have three very good medications. They work and they're proven, you know, and we're trying to convince these treatment programs around the country and doctors and therapists that the 12-step program, the spiritual support is important, but the medication is the primary thing that, that a lot of these patients need, where the success rate can go from maybe 1 to 10%, up to 50% or even 75% with certain kinds of treatment. But it doesn't mean that there's not still a need for a spiritual program. They should work together, and that's something, and that's been a difficult thing for a long time, that the program of Narcotics Anonymous has an official position against medical treatment for addiction. And, you know, so when I tell someone go to an NA meeting, I have to worry about them being told that they're going to have to come off of their medication.
And that's the scary part. And I, just like what you said, I really wish that they were combined more, just because it's the whole person viewpoint. Because imagine if someone, even in their everyday life, let's say someone's just beginning to think about quitting smoking, if every time that they had that cigarette in their hands, if they had to say just a phrase of, I don't want to deal with this right now, and then just take a step and be like, what am I not dealing with? They sit and journal for 10 minutes about what am I not dealing with, and then see if they want a cigarette. So same thing with the alcohol principle or opioids or any other kind of thing, whatever that emotional belief is, if they really just said that emotional belief that they found out about before that they ended up trying that substance and journaling it about it for 10 minutes, I wonder if the rate would cut down significantly. Even the same thing with eating and diets. If people just said, okay, why am I choosing to overeat? Why do I want to eat junk food right now? They sit and journal about it for 10 minutes just to see if they would still go out and binge, or if they, their binge craving would go away.
And that's a good point. Journaling, you know, writing is really a great thing. You know, seeing, you know, writing things down on paper and then reading back what you wrote is completely different from just thinking to yourself.
Right, and I would love to distinguish the difference between thinking, just thinking your own thoughts compared to journaling, because this is a concept that I really had a hard time understanding. When you go in and you journal and you just write, you free write, you don't really think about what you're writing, you just kind of puke on paper kind of deal, you end up figuring out, oh my God, this is actually bothering me. I had no idea this was bothering me. Sometimes it's even, let's say someone didn't hold the door open for you 2 hours ago, and you sit and see that on your journal paper, and you're like, that really bothered me? I had no idea I internalized that. So it's, I think journaling is super helpful for just bringing up the unconscious beliefs. And typically what causes those addiction patterns and just physical symptoms in general is not dealing with those unconscious beliefs.
Yeah, and that is also that's a big part of the 12-step program is to do a lot of writing. In fact, another guest I had on, you know, has many decades clean and recovery, and he says that when he sponsors someone, when he has a sponsee, the first assignment he gives them is to keep a gratitude list and write down as many things as they can think of that they're grateful for, and that's also sort of a test that if they can't, he wants them to come up with a lot of things, but if they can't come up with anything, he'll say, just write down three things. And after 3 weeks, if they can't even come up with three things they're grateful for, then he just tells them at that point, you're not ready for this yet. You know, come back to me when you can write a list of things that you're grateful for.
And another thing that I would like to point out too that might be helpful for your listeners is just to distinguishing the difference between your ego and your soul. Your soul is who you are no matter what body you're in or what, just any environment that you live in. Your body just tends to be your house that you stay in. Your ego is that little thing in your head that tells you everything that you're doing incorrectly, everything you're doing wrong, things that you need to do better. So one exercise that I do with patients and personal clients is I have them name their ego, just because their soul is typically the name that they go by anyway. So for instance, my ego's name is Charlotte. So anytime I start hearing, Rachel, you're not good enough, you're doing this wrong, this isn't going right, you'll never do this quite right, I say, okay, I understand this is Charlotte right now. And then in my head, I imagine a closet opening and this little itty-bitty circle named Charlotte. I stuff her in that closet, I shut the door, and sometimes if Charlotte's just being really awful, I like imagine a tranquilizer gun, like those little teeny tiny arrows going into her and like sedating her, like, ego, you do not have a chance to talk right now. We can talk when we're going to journal. That's when I'll let you out and you can say everything you want to say. Right now, Rachel needs to be here and be focused. This is Rachel's life, not yours. So even with the addiction thing, I don't have any addictions, but I would imagine this might happen in someone's head that does, of that nasty ego voice saying, hey, you need to do this. You're not good enough, and this is why you need to do this and cover up this feeling. So it would be an interesting thing for someone to do to see if that would help, is to give their ego a name. Imagine that ego or that character or whatever that ego looks like, stuffing them in a closet and only allowing them to talk when you journal, so that you're able to live your life without all of these negative thoughts around you all the time.
And that's really interesting, the idea of you know, giving your ego a name. And when you say ego, do you mean like just that voice in your head that's always talking?
Yeah, that vicious voice in your head that's always nasty to you. Because one thing that I've noticed just in my own healing journey is that people tend to associate that nasty, vicious voice as themselves, and it really isn't. It's a separate entity from you. You are your soul, not your ego. Your ego is made to protect, quote-unquote, protect you from harm and danger and everything like that. When we live in a relatively safe world, ego is important if you're about to jump off a cliff or something, like, hey, this is not a good idea. But in general, it just fills our brains with unnecessary fears that we don't need to have.
It reminds me, what you're talking about reminds me of a book by Michael Singer, The Untethered Soul. It talks about the voice in your head, and that's how he got started in his spiritual journey, is that he was a professor and one day just thought about, he woke up one day and thought, what is this voice in my head always talking? Am I the voice? Am I the thing that's thinking, or am I something else? And came to the conclusion that there's a brain. The brain is always talking to itself, and there's a brain which is part of the body, and then there's the actual person, I guess what you would call the soul, that who you are is actually the observer behind all of it, you know, watching all of that and hearing all that talking going on in your head. And I guess early on, for a long time in his journey, he worked to quiet that voice. And I actually heard him in a lecture more recently, and he says that's not so much important to him anymore, but just being always aware that that voice is not you.
Absolutely. And it's even just an interesting exercise that the listeners can just sit here and do, is just sit on the floor cross-legged or in a comfortable position and just be. Like, brain is completely quiet. Anytime that voice starts to talk, understand that isn't you. You can just sit and be. When you're just sitting being, that is you, nothing else. Whenever you hear like a voice start talking, you're worrying, like, I have to get this done, I have to get dinner on the table, that is ego all the way. You are literally just this thing that's sitting and being right now.
Do you practice daily meditation on a regular basis? Like we follow your own breathing and sit quietly like that for a certain amount of time?
I try to once a week. I try to set about 45 minutes aside where I will just lay on the couch, and anytime I start to hear that voice, I just write down whatever they're saying in a journal, and then I go back to quiet. Anytime I hear that voice, I write down what they're saying and put it in the journal. And it's just practicing, again, being aware of that you're just this thing in a body that's just being. Anytime you have this vicious voice in your head, it's just telling you things that you don't need to hear, filling your head with false beliefs, false fear, or it's also bringing awareness of the things that really bother you. And by writing those down, when I do that process, I can go back and look at it and say, okay, was I really hurt by this? If I was, what can I do to help shift that so that I'm not hurt by it anymore? So that's typically the process that I use anyway, just a nice balance of ego and soul in one.
Now your abilities, do you feel, is it something that maybe a lot of people might have these abilities latent and they're just not awake, or they're just not quietly looking or seeing the things around them? Or maybe like perfect pitch is something that a person either has or they don't have. It's something you have to be born with, if you can identify what a pitch is or not. And only a small number of people have that. Do you think that your gift of what you see and hear is something that either you have or you don't have?
I think specific areas of it. So let's say if someone has the gift of seeing, or if someone has the gift of hearing, or someone has the gift of communicating with spirit, they can definitely develop that. And it might not come in strong when they're little or growing up, and it may take time to develop. But I don't think anyone can ever develop everything at once, if that makes sense. It's kind of like no one can be a perfect doctor, a lawyer, and a gymnast in addition to being a perfect auto mechanic. Like, we can't do everything perfectly. We already have our set skills in place, or just things we're naturally good at. So that's more what I tend to believe in, of that people do have things that they can work on and they can develop if they choose to. A lot of people just aren't aware of it, they choose not to, or they don't even know where to start.
Okay. Yeah, maybe like with the music analogy, with perfect pitch, a person can develop very strong relative pitch where they can identify intervals and become a very successful musician or composer without having perfect pitch. So, you know, maybe in that same way, a person can develop by working hard, you know, strong skills, but maybe not have that natural talent to be able to do certain things.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I think that people can definitely develop their gifts over time just by learning anything. It might just take them a longer period of time than it would with someone that it just comes naturally with. So even when I was a little kid, I saw these shapes and signs and symbols and things like that, but I didn't have anyone to help me understand what it was. So if I never met mentors and things of that nature and just the information that I have now, I don't know if I would be doing the work that I'm doing now. So I do think it is possible to just develop it for any layperson that wants to. They just have to figure out kind of what their natural gift is and develop it from there. But I don't think that someone can be good at every single area. For even as an example, too, we talked a little bit about me talking about understanding people crossing over and being able to see them and communicate with them. Right now, I can only really do that with strong spirits. For example, I normally only talk to my boyfriend's grandfather and my grandpa. Those are the two major people that come in and talk to me. Occasionally, I'll get someone else, but if I don't know a person here on Earth very well, they're loved one probably won't come through to me. And there are some psychics out there that can just never have met someone before and immediately pick up on someone that's died or and passed away, and kind of like Teresa Caputo, and she just knows their name, they know all their habits that they do, what they wore, kind of their personality. She's much more gifted in that area. That's something that I could develop. I don't think I would ever be as good as her on that. It's possible. I would imagine it could be possible, but I don't think that I could ever get to the level that she's currently at, no matter how much I tried and practiced. I just think she's naturally gifted in that area.
Now sometimes my father passed away in 2008, and I sometimes hear people around me, you know, my wife or sometimes even just people I know or strangers, just out of the blue, they'll use a phrase that he commonly used, and just seems very unlikely that they would just happen to use this unusual phrase. And it could just be coincidence, but, you know, sometimes I wonder, is that like, you know, my father, you know, trying to communicate with me or, you know, or just some kind of a sign of his presence. Do you think that people in their everyday life get those kind of communications from people that have passed on?
I do. And just from experiences talking to like my grandfather and my boyfriend's grandfather, sometimes they'll sit here and like yell at me and they're like, Rachel, I tried telling you this 2 weeks ago. And I'm like, what do you mean? They're like, I sent you this. Did you not see it? I'm like, yeah, I saw it. Like it was a red airplane. And they're like, yeah, I was trying to tell you this. Like, how did you not get that from the red airplane? I'm like, are you speaking English? How would I understand that I need to do this certain action by seeing the red airplane? So I think that they always try to communicate with us. Just like I think sometimes on the other side, they forget that we're human and we speak English and we need signs that are very in our face. So one thing that I always tell people when they feel like they're getting messages from loved ones is to just sit with it for a second and see if they see a little spark in their eye or see if they feel kind of like an internal wiggly feeling or an internal wind. Typically, that's normally a symbol from spirit then. So for me, I normally see this little sparkle out of the corner of my eye whenever I know that was a symbol from someone. So let's say I did see a red airplane. I'm like, is that a coincidence? I'm not so sure. And then a little later, I end up blinking and I see this weird silver star in the corner of my eye. I'm like, okay, that was a symbol. Thank you. I'll pay attention. So I would just my advice to you would just be to stick with it once you hear that and just stand there for a second in silence and see if you feel anything different. See if you get like this weird warm feeling in your stomach. See if you see any sparkles. Or you could just ask to have that figure be more specific. Like, hey, Dad, I think you're trying to reach me right now. Can you give me another symbol to make sure that was you? Can you show me even just this little sparkle in the corner of my eye? Give me another symbol that it was you. Just keep asking from them because they can hear you. And it might not be immediately, but just know that even you talking out loud or in your head, they can still hear your thoughts. They can still communicate with you.
Yeah, that's incredible. Just the bigger picture of things beyond, you know, our daily experience. I wanted to ask you about maybe if you've had any experience with helping people or dealing with people that are in dysfunctional family systems, and maybe what the bigger picture is in relation to them. On another podcast episode, I discussed with a guest narcissistic parental abuse, you know, where there's a parent who, and this is a big popular topic now out there on the social media, the idea of a narcissistic person. And, you know, in these dysfunctional family systems, there's maybe a parent who's very controlling and manipulating and maybe even brainwashing the rest of the family to organize around one person, the scapegoat. And this person is beat up on by everybody else and is almost brainwashed into believing that they're a bad person. And the solution given by this the person I was talking to was they need to identify this maybe through therapy and have no contact, you know, get away from the abuse, get away from the emotional trauma. And is this something you've dealt with clients or in your own life? And you know, what is the bigger picture spiritually in relation to that?
I have dealt with it. So things that I would tell personal clients when this happens, let's say I have a 15-year-old that can't necessarily disconnect. Like, they can just not talk to them, but they still have to live in the same household. Like, no other family members will take them. They're virtually stuck. If they can come to the awareness point of this person, they can, and that they're only using what they've learned on how to cope with things, things start to become a lot less personal, and you become a lot more empathetic. So let's say you have a father figure and a 15-year-old girl. The father figure comes in and starts screaming at the girl that she didn't do, like, two of her dishes. And from a normal person's standpoint, yeah, that would be kind of a narcissistic thing. Like, how dare you not do your two dishes so that my house is clean? That kind of deal. But if the 15-year-old can build the awareness that this person is doing the absolute the best they can, and maybe their dad or their mom yelled at him like that whenever their dishes weren't done, then it becomes a much more, I'm sorry that that happened to you. And they're basically just expressing everything that they've went through on you. It has absolutely nothing to do with you. And just they're just trying to get out their hurt and frustration that they experienced in an earlier point in life.
In that discussion, the conclusion was that these controlling narcissistic people who very deliberately manipulate other people was that they're almost like a false person. You know, they're not even a real person, not a person that you can reason with, and that there might not even be hope for them. But that's hard to imagine that there's any human beings out there that are like robots, that malicious robots that don't have a soul, maybe. I mean, from a spiritual perspective, so these people that are abusing people emotionally, are they real people, right? I mean, they're people with souls that just have been maybe hurt themselves.
Yeah, I think they're absolutely real people with real souls. I would say that they've just been through so much trauma themselves, but that's the only way that they know how to handle it. I was watching a video, I think about a month ago, where it was talking about pedophilia, where this man, he would molest 12-year-old boys on purpose, and he knew that he was doing it. And his excuse for it in an interview was, well, my dad did that to me, and that was the only way that I got love. So I thought that I was loving these kids by doing that. Even though that sounds super twisted to the normal person, that makes complete sense as to why he did that. These narcissistic people are these people that are putting all of this negative energy and just awfully treating people. It's because that they don't know how to deal with their own trauma. So I do think, in short, I think they do have souls. I think they are real people, but they've been through so much that they didn't know how to handle it. And I'm sure someone else could make the counter argument that nice people go through horrific episodes of trauma as well, and they don't act like that. But for some reason, they had different internal resources and a different way to view it than that specific narcissistic person did. So I don't know if you could change that narcissistic person until they were ready to. They might never change because their trauma was so bad and they don't want to revisit it. And that's a choice that they've made. And the person that's being yelled at and screamed at can honor that of, And just remember, you've been through a lot. I don't know what you've been through that's causing you to act like this, but I respect your decision not to change. But I'm also going to put up boundaries so that when you do yell, I'm going to leave the room, or I'm going to do whatever else I best can to take care of myself. And if there isn't a way to do that, if they just have to yell and scream, you can just picture like a wall, like visualize a white wall in front of you, or a mirror, and that energy just bouncing right back at them, because that's essentially what they're doing, is they're just yelling at you what they're trying to tell themselves.
Yeah, that makes sense. And it is a difficult thing to be in the same room with a person like that. And, you know, so that's a good tool to use, maybe if you don't have the choice of leaving the room or leaving the home, and, you know, and you have to be with that person. Now, the opposite or different kind of person that we hear of being described as an empath, you know, somebody who is very emotionally sensitive and sensitive to the feelings of other people. And maybe the empath is a typical victim of the narcissist. But the empath has been described as someone who may even have their own kind of a special ability for being very sensitive to the feelings of people around them.
Sure. So I'm an empath, so I definitely understand where you're going with this question. I think it is up to the empath to establish boundaries and understand how they can disconnect from people. Because if they're not disconnecting from people, even if they know how to, then that's them being irresponsible and allowing people to hurt them. If they're not aware of it, then they just don't have the resources yet. And this can be a great resource for teaching an empath how to disconnect from someone like that. One thing you can do is the mirror or the wall thing that we just talked about. Another thing you can do is to picture, put your feet flat on the ground and picture that you have tree roots coming out of them and that you're deeply grounded into the earth. Another way to do that is to imagine that you're standing on the sand and physically squishing your toes in the sand to bring you back to this present moment. When you let's say I just wasn't grounded for any time being. Let's say I go to a Cardinals game in St. Louis. If I'm not grounded, I'm going to have spirits bombarding me. I'm going to feel the person's right arm pain three rows down to the right from me. Like, I am not taking responsibility for my own actions and how I feel. So as long as I'm in control and I'm aware of how I feel and I ground myself, other people's emotions will not bother me. So I would argue that empaths can definitely get in that victim mentality of, oh my God, I feel awful. This person's energy is destroying me. But at the same time, you're choosing to let that happen. So as long as you have resources and you understand how to ground yourself and how to separate that energy, there's no reason why you need to hang on to other people's pain, emotion, or belief.
That makes sense. So I have patients that come in for mainly opioid addiction, sometimes other kinds of addiction. And often their family members come in with them, or the family members encourage them to come in. In some cases, the family members aren't even local. Sometimes they're in another state, and they call and they say, please, you know, see my child. They're usually, you know, in their 20s, 30s. And, you know, the family member is concerned about them, but things have happened to the point where they don't want to be in the same state with them, or they can't be in the same state. You know, the person is here locally in Florida, and maybe the relative is, you know, wherever, New York, New Jersey, you know, somewhere else. And, if someone were to send you a picture, say a family member says, you know, I'm worried about my child. I'm going to send you some pictures of how they look. And can you tell me if they're in trouble? I don't know if that's a conflict or an issue. Can you look at pictures that come from somebody who, you know, from someone else that's not the person in the picture?
I could do that, but I choose not to, because that person is putting their effort into someone else's energy. If you can worry about someone else you want, but your main primary job as a human is to take care of you. Imagine the analogy that they always tell you in an airplane is you put your own oxygen on first, and then you help everyone else that you can. You're constantly worried about other people. That is not your business. I understand from an addiction standpoint that someone might be so far down the rabbit hole that they don't understand what they're doing to themselves, and you can sit and talk to them when they're ready and receptive to listen. I do not work on or treat with like emotional roots anyone that is not ready and does not personally come to me. My only exception is unless they're a minor under the age of 18, where they're still developing their own thoughts and feelings, and they might need an adult's help to do that. If I have a 25-year-old addict and I got their picture and their information from their grandmother or something, I would dismiss that case and say absolutely not. When that person is ready to change, they will come to me. You can give them my business card and say, Rachel can help you when you're ready. But if they don't personally come to me, I will not work on them.
For addiction, for the there's the medical treatment, the psychotherapy component, the group therapy. In addition, a person who's motivated to overcome their addiction but still has difficulties, or they need guidance, or they want more information about themselves, they could reach out to you and work with you to help them maybe to move forward in their therapy and their treatment.
Yes, anytime someone personally comes to me and says, I want to get better, I want to know things, I want more resources, I want more information, I am always happy to help them as a personal client. I do have two providers that I currently work with as well. One is a naturopath in Santa Monica, and one is a naturopath in Tulsa, Oklahoma. So they can get the physical information from those providers if they choose to work with them. Otherwise, they can come to me as personal clients, and I can help them work on the emotional and spiritual roots as to why they might be having an addiction problem.
How do you feel about the law of attraction? Some of the things that you've written, I don't think you ever use those words, at least not where I read it, but some of the things seem consistent with that the universe helping a person to get what they need or what they're asking for. What are your feelings on that?
I definitely believe in the law of attraction based off of unconscious beliefs. So it's much different for me to lay in my bed and say, oh man, I want $1 million, compared to actually sitting and believing that that's possible. Those are two completely separate things. So when you have someone come in for addiction or just the general medical things, if they truly believe that they can get better, that's typically when the treatment works. Just kind of like the placebo thing. When they truly believe that that pill works, that's when they see those benefits come up. So I do believe that people can attract what they want. If you have someone that's really sick of stage 4 cancer and they come to me and say, Rachel, I know I can get better, I just need some resources, let's figure out a way to see if you can help me or not, and they know that they can get better, I will never turn someone down that has that belief behind it. If someone says, you know what, they have a crappy attitude, like, I don't really know if this is going to work. Like, maybe it will, maybe it won't, whether that be with medication, the treatment, or just me in general, they're probably not going to have a great outcome towards it. So I always encourage people to just find and do what resonates with them as far as treatment option goes.
You know, everybody's afraid of dying, and everyone has different beliefs in what happens after death. Now, in your case, I mean, you see things, you've talked to people on the other side. So maybe in your case, it's not so much of a belief as actually knowing and seeing what happens. I mean, from your perspective, what happens when a person dies? I mean, from the very beginning to long term, what happens after death?
I think it depends on the nature of how someone died. If someone died peacefully in their sleep and they knew that they were going to die soon, from what I've experienced of seeing, people tend to just pass along graciously, and they're very happy on the other side and involved in other things they want to do. Sometimes souls that have died from suicide, addiction, awful ways to die, they normally get stuck in some way that they can heal, whether that be a cocoon, kind of like what a caterpillar does, or they're on a beach and they're laying out on those little beach chairs and they're on vacation. Sometimes souls go through a very traumatic process in passing, and they just need longer before they can accept what's kind of happened to them. And then they can transition over into, like, quote unquote, the normal heaven, like where everyone else is at and doing their thing. And they're just happy, and they're happy to talk to you, and they're happy to communicate messages for their loved ones. But I have a very hard time connecting with people that have died from, like, overdoses and suicides, because they're still extremely angry. They don't want to talk. They're like, this shouldn't have happened. I can't believe this happened. And they just go into this cocoon or lay out on the beach, and they just need time to heal and process, and then they'll transition over into the more cooperative, happy side of things. So no matter how you die or how you pass away, I believe deep down in my soul and my gut that people do end up living a very good, happy life, and they're content and happy on the other side.
Do you see any evidence of reincarnation being a real thing, that people live more than one life?
I do. I am a big believer in reincarnation. So in particular, I can see, I can sometimes just be aware of past lives. And I know, I have one spirit in particular that I talk to where he's been talking with me and he says, I really want to come back soon. So he's just deciding when the right time is and what body he wants to come back into. So I think that souls, if they want to, I think they have an opportunity to definitely come back here for another lifetime. I truly believe that humans are here to learn lessons and overcome those lessons, so that when we die in one life, we can come back later and learn a brand new lesson that we're still working on. It might just be in a different way. So let's say if someone's lesson here right now on this planet, right, planet Earth, they just want to learn how to fend for themselves. So maybe they grew up in the projects, or maybe they left home at 14 years old and they carried out their life that way, and then they gradually pass away. They might come back in another life if they did not feel like they learned that lesson, and it might be in a similar situation. It might be that they grew up in an abusive home with a mom this time, and they had to leave early and fend for themselves. It just depends on what your soul wants to learn, and that's typically the family and the environment that you come into.
There's been, for years, there's been books, and now more recently on YouTube and audiobook, there's people that claim to be channeling entities and releasing information and, you know, writing full books. I remember even when I was a lot younger, there was a book called The Entity Known as Michael, and there was another entity, I forgot his name. And now currently, I think there's a couple, an elderly couple that channels an entity, and they're all over YouTube. Do you get a sense ever of if these things are real, if they're not real?
And you're talking about like Abraham Hicks?
Yeah, that's
stuff
the one.
Like
yeah.
That?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I absolutely do think they are real. I certainly have never gotten to that level of being able to channel something like that. But I do think it is possible. That's just something that I don't quite understand at this point in time. But when I go through and read what they've written and see those videos and listen to that information, that resonates with me.
Yeah, also, in your writing, you mentioned that you work with a shaman. Is that something that maybe everybody should do, or is that something just someone in your unique situation that it benefits you? What is it like to work with a shaman?
From my understanding, different shamans do different things. It's kind of like medical doctors do. They recommend certain treatments. My specific shaman, I think the last time I saw her was maybe in 2015, if I remember correctly, and that was just because I was so overwhelmed with the negative side of spiritual things and entities that I just couldn't function anymore. If someone wants to, they're more than welcome to go and seek out a shaman. I personally only use one when I'm in deep crisis, because otherwise I just try to do normal maintenance with myself, smudging and staging the place where I live, and spiritual activities like that for cleansing. So in 2015, that was when I was really starting to get my head into doing this stuff, and the entities were definitely feeding off of my fear of, like, I don't know if I can do this. I don't know if this is real. What if people think I'm crazy? That kind of thing. So, if that answers your question, people are more than welcome to go see a shaman if they want to. I just typically see one when I'm in need of some great help.
Yeah, and you just reminded me, when you talk about, like, you know, maybe a malicious entity, you know, causing difficulties for you, that I've heard people say that, you know, from the Christian perspective, that there's angels and demons fighting a war and battles all around us, and we just don't see it. Is that something that can be interpreted in terms of what you experience? Is that the same thing?
Yeah. So as an example, when I see entities come in, or I hear them whispering in my ear, or they'll start like pulling my shirt in the middle of the night, I ask for a specific angel to watch over me. I ask for Archangel Michael. And then if I still don't feel quite safe with just him, I can call on, I don't really have a specific term for these things because I don't know what their real name is, but I call them warrior or protector angels. They're about 10, 11 feet tall. And whenever they just stand in the room by the entity, then the entity will go away. So sometimes when I'm really bombarded with entity things, I'll have about 12 to 30 protector angels in there, along with Archangel Michael, just to make sure that nothing bad will happen, or that I don't see these things anymore. I don't have horrific nightmares anymore. People aren't tugging at my shirt or bruising my skin or things like that. So I definitely think that angels can help get rid of the demon side of things.
So for your average person, maybe prayer would help. I mean, like, you know, if they're in a difficult situation, that they could, you know, just even if they don't see the protector by them or the angel, they could maybe pray for help when they're in a difficult situation.
Absolutely. If you just have the general intention of I need good things to come from heaven or where your nice spiritual place is, that has these energetic beings or these higher frequency beings, as long as you ask for that and you acknowledge them, they are more than happy to help.
Specifically in the case of addiction, when a person is laying in bed at night and they've been clean for a few days or a week, and they're suffering with cravings and they want to stop using, but they have that persistent craving in their head that you should go out and use one more time. You know, you can do it. Whether it's caused by psychological reasons or, you know, a damaged feedback system in the brain, or if it's also partly caused by some malicious thing out there telling you, you know, you need to go harm yourself. Either way, I mean, prayer is a known thing. You know, in the 12-step programs, they recommend, you know, if you're by yourself and you're in a bad space, that you need to pray, you need to write, you need to, you know, call someone for help.
I think that prayer is definitely helpful. I do it when I feel unsafe. I try to do it for gratitude purposes. I definitely don't see anything wrong with doing that. And again, just calling for help, they're more than happy to be a resource, but I want to emphasize the word resource, that they are not in control of your life. They just help guide you and help protect you. You are at the end of the day. They can be a resource. Journaling can be a resource. Counseling can be a resource. Rehab can be a resource. Doctors can be a resource. But at the end of the day, it just comes back to you and that vicious voice. And again, you could just try doing that vicious voice exercise with naming that ego and putting it in a closet, or in allowing it a time to speak when you say it can with that journaling activity. That just use all the resources that come in and resonate best with you. So one resource might work great one week, and the next week it might not work so great. Just keep going, keep trying. Just again, understand that your soul is just in a body and it's just being. Every time something else happens, that's your ego talking.
So those exercises you discussed, like feeling like you're rooted in the ground or imagining a wall in front of you, those might be useful, whether the malicious voice is your own ego or a person outside of you, a narcissist or an entity. Either way, that you could, or you're saying you could do those same kind of exercises.
Yes, those exercises would also work. Anything that helps you bring your awareness back to that you're okay where you're currently at right here and right now. You're not in danger. Your head is just going through with thoughts. Your body, your physical body right now is okay. If you're laying in bed having those cravings on the sidewalk, even if you're going through withdrawal right now, that you are okay. So I know that one exercise to bring awareness, if you're even having a panic attack, when it gets so severe, you can look at something far away and then look at something close to you, look at something else far away, and then look at something else close to you in a different spot. That just helps your body and you in general just reiterate that you're okay. You're here, right now. You're not in the future. You're not in the past. You're right here, right now.
Rachel Reimer, thank you very much for joining me on the podcast. It was really an honor. It was a pleasure to have you here, and thank you for joining me.
Thank you for talking with me, Mark. I'm always happy to share information.
Thank you for joining us today on The Rehab on the Mental Health News Radio Network. I hope that you have found this show to be interesting and useful. If so, please subscribe to The Rehab Podcast and share on social media. I appreciate your taking the time to listen to The Rehab.